listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. With me is co-host extraordinaire, Dr. Melody Fox. Melody, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? How was your Easter?
Easter was wonderful. It was very relaxing. Had a nice brunch with friends, and wouldn't have changed a thing.
Sounds much more exciting than mine. I got to spend the first 4 hours of the morning at traffic school.
On Easter?
On Easter
they
morning.
Booked it on Easter.
Well, I have a deadline in a couple days, so yeah, I went ahead and did that. But the afternoon was nice. I spent it with my nieces and Easter egg hunts and the park and all that. So that
nice.
Was nice.
Yeah. Nice. Very good.
Yeah, I hate to admit, but I do tend to speed a little bit now and again. And I got caught. So, consequences for actions, right?
That's
the choices
right.
we make.
Exactly.
But I'm really excited about today, Alan. I'm really looking forward to having a great show, as I know our guests will continue to bring them, you know, we'll continue to bring them answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
Absolutely. Each week we will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
And with each of us combined, Alan, we have over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, and we've both been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this a better world and a better place for all of us.
And we will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family.
Now today we'll be talking about a new book that can be best be described as a memoir that allows the reader to truly enter the mind of a person with psychological and neurological disorders, and with their permission, of course. As our guest today is Melissa Benstock, a 22-year-old college student and author of a brand new book, which is fabulous, Nourishment, Feeding My Starving Soul When My Mind and My Body Betray Me.
Yeah, and by the time Melissa was 11 years old, she had already been diagnosed with 6 disorders, taken 14 different medications, and seen 10 doctors. Some of Melissa's disorders include such things as Tourette's syndrome, OCD, dyslexia, ADHD, anorexia, and generalized anxiety disorder.
Now, with all that being said, Melissa has won awards for her writing, including the Gold Key Award, and has been honored numerous times for her contributions to the community.
And Melissa, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. And before we learn more about your book, our first question, since our last time in which you were going to be on, is how are you doing?
I'm doing much better. I was unfortunately just in a car accident a couple of weeks ago, but things are much better now.
Okay. Well, I know at the time of the accident, it just happened before you came on the air or were going to come on the air, and you were still a little bit in shock. You said you were physically okay. Are you still physically okay?
Yes, I was a little bit sore afterwards, but everything is okay. Thank goodness nobody got hurt.
Well, what about your car? Did your car get hurt?
My car, unfortunately, did get hurt. Luckily, I accidentally hit a woman's SUV, so her car wasn't damaged. But my little car, the front, the car kind of got squashed. But it's okay. You know, that's what we have insurance for.
And that's why you have a car protecting you from the other cars, right?
So
you don't get
definitely.
Hurt. Well, good. We are so happy to hear that you're doing well and that you weren't hurt more than a little bit of soreness. So that's great. Well,
thank
welcome
you.
To Answers for the Family. We are so excited about your book, and I have it here in front of me. And I just, you know, I was reading parts of it here and there, and I just really enjoyed it. And it flows so nicely. You're a brilliant writer, by the way, but you know
nothing
that. You've been awarded for your writing, but it really is a nice read, a nice read, and very interesting, too.
So, Melissa, what initially led you to write this book?
Well, I was really just trying to understand myself and, you know, including the origin and evolution of my disorders, because I literally grew up feeling as though I had been betrayed by my mind and my body, and that experience was so catastrophic to me that I really just needed to make sense of my experience and what had happened to me and what had transpired, and that led me to writing. And initially, the book actually started out as a journal, and I had no intentions of publishing or anything like that. But as the book grew longer, I realized that, you know, maybe my story could help somebody else or somebody's family or somebody's doctor. And that's when I tried to pursue publishing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about your struggles with the different diagnoses that they gave you, Tourette's syndrome, dyslexia, and other disorders. When did you first notice that you might be a little bit different than the other kids?
It really happened around second grade. All of my other friends were reading and were succeeding in school, whereas I was experiencing a lot of trouble. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. And that's when I began to realize that, I'm not quite like everybody else. And that was also the year that I began experiencing symptoms of Tourette syndrome, which is basically a neurological condition which is characterized by these involuntary movements and vocalizations called tics. Mm-hmm. So here I am, unable to read, and having all of these movements and vocalizations that I had no control over. And that's when I really hit it, when it really hit me that I wasn't, quote-unquote, normal.
Well, I'm just curious because we've heard a lot in the news lately about bullying and all that. Were the other kids understanding, or were you teased at all for being a little bit different?
Yeah, I mean, I was teased a lot by other children my own age, but more than anything, though, I was sort of ostracized by my teachers, which was very strange looking back at it now, mm-hmm. because you would figure that adults would be more accepting and more accommodating, and yet the adults that I encountered, unfortunately, were not. My first elementary school actually asked my parents to take me out of that school because I wasn't a cookie cutter child and I didn't fit into that nice, neat mold that they were trying to produce, so to speak.
Right.
And then subsequently after that, I went to a school for kids with learning disabilities and my teacher there actually sat me in the corner facing the wall because I was a distraction to the other children.
Well, that kind of is a disservice for the whole purpose of being at a school that works with people with disabilities.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I can only imagine what effect that had on your self-esteem and your place in the world.
Yeah, I really felt as though, you know, I was this person that was sort of peering into the world but never really participating. I was an outsider to my classmates. I was an outsider to my teachers, and there came a point in which I became an outsider to my family because of all of these issues that I was struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then in Nourishment, you sort of talk a little bit about, I mean, that you kind of tried to hide the Tourette's, and is that what brought about the struggles with your eating disorder and anorexia?
Yeah, the eating disorder, first I need to put this in there. Everybody on my father's side has some sort of an eating disorder, whether it's anorexia, bulimia, or compulsive overeating. So there is a biological basis to an eating disorder. But the social issues that I was struggling with and the psychological issues that I was struggling with really triggered the eating disorder because, as I said, I really felt as though my mind and my body had betrayed me. And for me, the way to regain control over some facet of my life was by controlling what I ate, and that's what I began to do. Well, and that started when I was about 8 years old when everything else was sort of spiraling out of control.
Well, I've noticed, too, a lot of people with eating disorders or other control disorders, the rest of their life seems so out of control. That is the one thing that they can control, other than the bowel and all that other,
right.
The other end. But that is really interesting. I'm just curious how your family reacted to that early on, because it seemed to, from what you're saying, had a lot of insight at such an early age that led you to make some other decisions for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, very difficult for my family. They took me to all sorts of therapists and diagnosticians and doctors and so on. And really, there came a point at which my family, based on my parents, they put all of their faith in the doctors because they expected the doctors to be able to guide them and instruct them and tell them what to do. But unfortunately, the psychiatrist that I saw basically were more interested in prescribing me medications than treating me as a person and telling my parents to take me to therapy and so on. So I really became more of an experiment, mm-hmm. Than anything. And then in terms of the eating disorder, my parents actually took me to my pediatrician. And at the time, my mom said, I think that Melissa has early onset anorexia, and my pediatrician actually said, no, you know, she's too young for that. That can't be right. And so my mom that put my mom's mind at ease, but in the back of her mind, I think that she definitely still had the worry that, no, something doesn't feel quite right about this, because she's losing weight and she's restricting what she's eating and there's something not right.
Well, you know, in your book, you talk a lot about what you refer to as the sick person, and that heart prevented you from eating. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the sick person is basically, I believe that we all have a sick person. It is that voice in our head that tells us negative things about ourselves, whether, you know, it tells us that we're overweight or unlovable or so on. But in my case, I believe that this sick person became so overpowering and so strong that she basically took over, and that was the only voice that I heard. And she basically told me things that I was disgusting and unlovable and just a vile person. And I really became her prisoner, so to speak, and I began to listen to her and only her. And that led me on the path of destructive behavior, such as the eating disorder, purging, cutting, things like that.
So did you see the sick person as a separate person from you, like a schizophrenic?
In the beginning, I did. I recognized that she was this person residing within me, separate from me, yet still a part of me, which is kind of paradoxical, but, you know, with all paradoxes, it speaks to truth. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, she became the only voice that I would hear, and I had a hard time distinguishing between the sick person and me. Mm-hmm. And that's when things kind of got scary, because I would only listen to her.
And everything that she said that you were or told you to do was more negative and harmful?
Exactly, yes. Whether it was restricting or purging or over-exercising or cutting or any sort of destructive behavior, I would engage in that behavior in order to appease the sick person, because as I talk about in the book, I basically felt as though she was screaming at me all the time, almost 24/7. And so the ways that I could appease her was through this restrictive, harmful behavior.
Right.
Now, how did you get to a point to where you realized that this is not the voice that you need to be listening to?
That really came about when I was about 16. Another big part of the book that I talk about is my relationship with an abusive horse trainer. My relationship with my parents had become so damaged because of all of the struggles that we had about medications and eating and not eating and so on, but I really felt as though my parents, particularly my mother, could not love me. Mm-hmm. And yet I yearned for that mother-daughter relationship, and I sought that through my horse trainer, because I was a competitive horseback rider, and unfortunately, my horse trainer was not a very kind person.
Now,
and she basically abused that relationship and encouraged me to engage in these restrictive behaviors. And there came a point at which everything sort of fell apart. My life with horseback riding wasn't going well. I was weak. I was sick. And I realized that something isn't right here. I can't live like this. And that voice in my head that is telling me things obviously cannot be me, because she's trying to kill me. And that's when I recognized that this is a sick person. This is not me.
Right. Now, I'm just wondering, is the horse trainer you're talking about the same one in the book that chastised you the first time she gave you some clippers to clip her horse for the show?
Yes, that is the self-same horse trainer.
Right. I read that part because I love horses and working with horses, and that behavior and her attitude and the horrible things she said to you, because you made an honest mistake. You know, things happen. And if that was just a touch of the abuse that she gave you, you know, it's amazing you survived that with your ego intact.
Yeah, I mean, she would tell me things that, like, I was unlovable, like my mother couldn't love me, like she was the only one that could love me. She one time told me that I was dirt and to sit in the dirt because that's where I belonged. I mean, it was a lot of verbal abuse.
Mm. Right. And if you can talk a little bit more about that, because I think some of the things that some of the teenagers that we work with, when we talk with them, they get to a point to where they feel that they, for whatever reason, need to pull away more from their parents. And as they do that, too often there is somebody like this that steps into their life. Mm-hmm. And I think that for people to hear, and that it's not always positive, that, you know, there's so many times that we will talk with a young person that'll say, you know, but you don't understand, you know, I ran away because I'm with this person because they're the only one that loves me, or they're the only one that cares about me. And in many cases, it really isn't somebody that loves them. It's somebody who's exploiting them or taking advantage of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was exactly what happened with my horse trainer. It was a very insidious cycle of abuse. I believed that my parents couldn't love me. She offered me this love that I thought was real and I thought was actual. And so I sought to please her. Mm-hmm. And I never realized that she wasn't really interested in me. She was interested in my parents' money and having them spend money on expensive horses from Europe and horse shows and things like that. And it never dawned on me that, wait, maybe this person doesn't really care about me. Maybe she just wants something from me. And so that really catalyzed that horrible cycle of abuse that I just kept running back to her, and I kept forgiving her, and I kept, you know, coming to the conclusion that, no, I was wrong in this situation and she was right. And all along, I was just deceived, and I didn't really recognize that until basically she had me buy two horses from her, and she was intending on having me, my parents buy a third horse for me. And I said, look, I cannot keep going back to my parents and asking them to spend this kind of money on horses. It's just unrealistic, and I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And she basically told me, well, I'm not interested in you anymore. Go somewhere else.
Wow.
And that all happened around the same time that I was really restricting and losing a lot of weight and just basically sick of everything. And I was at that point beginning to realize that there's just something not right. I need to go away and figure stuff out. And that's actually when I went to treatment for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine that need to please was really there and ingrained. And was your thought process, if I please that person, they'll love me? And that means I'm worth
Absolutely.
Something? Or is that kind of the thinking that you've come to conclude to?
Absolutely. I really thought that if I did everything perfect, if I could be perfect for this person, then she would love me and I would finally feel good about myself. And unfortunately, she basically her expectations were unobtainable and she wasn't even really interested in me as a person. Mm-hmm. And so this whole time, this pursuit of this love was just, you know, something that was never going to happen. I was never going to achieve it. And I didn't realize that for a long time. I started training with her when I was 12, and I didn't leave until I was 16. So there were a lot of years there that I was trying to pursue her love and never realizing that it was unattainable.
Right. Now, you had mentioned a moment ago that you ended up starting going to a lot of doctors around that time. Now, I know at a young age, you must have found yourself dealing with, you know, as you mentioned, doctors on a regular basis. And working with different psychiatrists and working with children in the foster care industry, they go from place to place to place, and every place has their own doctor and every place has their own diagnosis and nobody's on the same page. What was your experience, if you wouldn't mind sharing, with your doctors and your medication and the journey you had to take on that?
Well, my experience with doctors and medications was a very chaotic one. I was basically shuffled from doctor to doctor, and given different medications and different cocktails of medications in order to try to control the Tourette syndrome. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, none of the medications worked very well. None of the doctors were very interested in really helping me develop as a person. They were more interested in subduing the tics.
Right.
So my experience with doctors from a very early age was, unfortunately, a very negative one.
Well. Was there some form of side effects? In other words, once you start getting on these cocktails of different medications, at what level do you start not really taking medication for the problem, but you're now taking medication for the side effects?
Yeah, the side effects are pretty atrocious. Anything from lethargy to anxiety to extreme mania to extreme depression, weight gain, weight loss. There actually was a point in which I couldn't even go to school for a substantial period of time because I was just too drowsy. I couldn't wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. And some of the side effects actually led doctors to diagnose me with things like bipolar disorder and different personality disorders, which I actually didn't have. Mm-hmm. But the doctors didn't realize that these symptoms that they were seeing were actually just side effects from the medication. They thought that I had different disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very chaotic and crazy time. It really made me loathe and detest doctors of all sorts. I was just so resistant to going to doctors for a really long time because I thought that they couldn't help me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that changed when I got older and I was placed in the hands of a psychiatrist who I really began to trust and was really interested in helping me develop as a person. So I saw the other side of psychiatry.
Well, and that's really important when you're looking at psychiatrists. And I know working at different places and talking to different children and young adults, going to different psychiatrists, some really take an interest and really listen to what their client is saying, and others just go, oh, what do you want? You know, what's going on with you?
Yeah.
We'll give you that pill. Okay, that doesn't work. Okay, next time we'll try this, instead of actually trying something and really working with the child. But a lot of times it's because they get moved from doctor to doctor, place to place, and they all have their own agenda and want to make their own mark or whatever on their territory. But I'm so thrilled to hear that you did find one that you did come to trust. But going back to your experience with doctors and medications, I think I read somewhere that they were experimenting on you and using medications that hadn't been approved to be used in the U.S.?
Yeah, actually, I was given medications that hadn't been approved by the FDA yet for use in the United States. I was also given Botox injections in my face in order to try to paralyze the tics, which was all well and good. It worked for about a month, but I also couldn't make facial expressions for that time period. So that was pretty scary to me. I was only 9 at that point. And I also had an allergic reaction to an antipsychotic medication that ended up putting me in the hospital, and a lot of scary things. And I really did begin to feel like a lab rat that was being experimented on. And I had a doctor that just placed me in a room and sat me on this stool and just videotaped me for 30 minutes so that he could just observe me.
Wow.
And it was just all so very strange to me and scary, because nothing was ever explained to me. And nothing was ever explained to my parents in terms of side effects and what might happen and what might not happen and expectations.
Right.
So much for full disclosure on things.
Exactly.
And especially happening when you're 9 years old. I just look at my nieces that are around 9 and all the other 9-year-olds I know, and they're busy playing with Barbie dolls and having tea parties with friends and going to the park and playing and interacting. Your life was so totally different.
Really?
And, yeah, it really was different.
And how were you feeling towards your parents? In other words, at this point in time, one is that, you know, how is this affecting your parents? But also, were you at this point starting to feel like, you know, your parents were allowing this to happen, and maybe you were starting to pull away from them?
Absolutely. At this time, my relationship with my mom especially became very strained, because I felt as though she was either the food police or the pill pushers. And I didn't realize at the time that my mom was just so desperate to help me that she had placed all of her faith in the psychiatrist's hands. And all I saw was, well, she's just force feeding me pills, and I don't like what the pills are doing to me. And so we began to argue a lot about medications, and I began to refuse to take medications. My mom became so desperate that she would basically go to extreme measures to try to ensure that I would take the medication, such as calling the police and the ambulance when I wouldn't take my medications. There was a point at which I think I was about 10 years old, and the police actually came, and they broke down the door because I had locked myself in the bathroom in order to not take the medications. And there were all sorts of threats about hospitalizations and so on. And I basically at the time thought that my mom just didn't love me anymore, and I didn't realize that all of these things that my mom was doing had been instructed, given to her by my psychiatrist. So he had given her these instructions to, well, if Melissa doesn't take her medication, then you need to call 911. If Melissa doesn't take her medications, you need to take her to the hospital. I thought it was all just coming from my mom. Mm-hmm.
Right, and I think you bring up a great point, and it's one of those things to where the reality is it's being done out of love. The more that they're doing it, it's the more of their way of showing how much they love you and how much they're going to go even beyond their own comfort zone to do what they truly believe is right. And it's one of those things that a lot of us are told, and that is that, you know, if you go and hire a brain surgeon, you ought to be taking the brain surgeon's advice, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's the same type of thing. If you go and you get a top psychiatrist and they're saying that this is what you have to do for your child to become well, is as hard as it may be, I think it really does show how much love is there that they'll go to that extent to still do it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I just, you know, as a child, I wasn't able to see it that way. But looking back on it, I really see how much my parents loved me and how much they were trying to help me get better.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did things begin to turn around for you? Because all this happened at a very early age, and you were going through all this, and you're only 22 now. So, at what was the turning point for you?
Well, the initial turnaround began when I was 16. I went away to treatment for about 4 months, an out-of-state treatment facility for anorexia nervosa. And that's when my relationship with my family really began to mend and we really began to heal, because I was in an out-of-state location away from everything, and I really was able to sort things out and try to gain an understanding of what had happened to me and what had happened with my family. And we actually had a very intense week of family therapy where everything was really laid out on the table and everyone was able to talk about their feelings and to talk about what they had experienced. And that was the first time that I really recognized, wow, look at all my parents did for me. Look how much they cared about me. When I was perceiving what they were doing to me as negative, they were really showing me how much they loved me. And that was really the first time that I saw that. Mm-hmm. And so the treatment experience really helped things turn around and helped me mend my relationships with my family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, recovery was an ongoing process from then. I relapsed subsequently about a year later and was hospitalized once again. But the significant factor of that first treatment experience was that my relationship with my family became a lot better after that.
Now, how big is your family, brothers, sisters? Older, younger?
I have an older sister, and I have a younger sister, and then it's my mother and my father. And so I'm the middle child.
So what do you think their experience was with you as a sister going through all that?
My older sister and I were very close when we were growing up. We rode ponies together. We went to horse shows together. We had a lot of the same friends because we're very close in age. But unfortunately, with all of these disorders evolving and changing, our relationship was really strange, and we sort of drifted away from each other because of this, these issues that I was facing. And then my younger sister is a bit younger than me, and she unfortunately didn't really get to experience me before all of my disorders really developed. Mm-hmm. So our relationship didn't develop for a long time because she never really got to experience the real Melissa, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But we really got to heal when I was in treatment. We got to basically reestablish or even establish our relationship.
So I imagine you're a supporter of treatment centers that work with a family as a whole.
Absolutely. You know, when you are sent away to treatment, there are issues that you have to work on. But when you come home, you're back in that setting, the same setting, and the family is a huge role in your recovery. And so I think it's essential that the family becomes involved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's something that I have promoted for a long time, the aftercare, getting the whole family involved.
Right.
It is huge in any family for everybody to heal. Our guest today is Melissa Binstock. She is the author of Nourishment, Feeding My Starving Soul When My Body and Mind Betrayed Me. We'll be right back.
Quick break.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back when the mics are up.
That's right.
And I'm Dr. Melody Fox with Alan Cardoza. Together we are Answers for the Family. Today we are talking with Melissa Binstock, an amazing young woman who wrote the book Nourishment, Feeding My Starving Soul When My Mind and Body Betray Me. And welcome back, Melissa. And again, thank you for being here today and discussing, you know, your experiences and part of the book with us. And we were just curious, what did... advice would you give a young listener who may be struggling with any of these or similar conditions? And, you know, because you've lived with this. You know what it's like to have psychological and neurological disorders. How can they cope with this?
Well, I would say, you know, never give up. Because even though things look dark and grim at a particular point in your life, things always ultimately get better. So that's the first piece of advice that I would give. And something that really helped me when things were pretty bad was to make goals for myself, both small goals, easily achievable, and long-term goals. So for me, that meant, you know, today I'm going to add something like 10 calories. And small goals like that really helped me get through the day because I could focus on those goals. Mm-hmm. And then the long-term goals also kind of drove me and kept me on the road to recovery because one of the long-term goals that I made was I want to go to graduate school. I want to get a PhD. And in order to do that, I know that I need to stay healthy and I need to eat in order to maintain myself. Mm-hmm. And so having those short-term goals and long-term goals in mind really helped me recover. And then a third piece of advice I would give would be to use your family and your friends as a support system because they are an essential part of the recovery process. Mm-hmm. And you really can't do it without a support system. So whether it's your friends, whether it's your family, whether it's a support group, find somebody that can help you. Mm. And that's really the advice that I would give.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. And I think we all should be more dependent upon our family and look to them for support, too, and hopefully they are there for us to give it to us. Now, we do have a couple guest questions for you, comments that came over the email for us that are directed towards you, Melissa. And the first one is, 3 years ago, I was hospitalized with anorexia. It took a year and a half to modify my behavior and, most importantly, my relationship with food, what I term my enemy. After reading your site and other conditions that you've also had to overcome, I feel that I actually had it easy. I encourage anyone with this disorder or this order to run, not walk, to get help. I'm 33 now and have irreparable damage to my heart and digestive tract. Now, that's something that's not talked about too much, Melissa, is the side effects of anorexia and bulimia is the damage to your body. Did you experience any of that?
Yes. Unfortunately, I damaged my liver due to the years of restrictive eating. I also damaged my teeth. I basically, because of the purging that I was engaging with, I basically wore away a lot of the enamel on my front teeth and they had to be replaced. I also lost a lot of the calcium in my bones. I had osteopenia for quite a while. That luckily has gotten better. But yes, I did experience a lot of negative side effects from the years of restricting and the years of not nourishing myself properly. And that's definitely something very scary that we don't even realize when we are engaging in these destructive behaviors, we don't even realize the long-term effects that they can have.
Now, what are some of the things that you've been able to do to reverse some of that?
Well, once I was eating well and nourishing myself, I was able to, you know, have menses again, which definitely helped with my bones and helped restore my bones and their strength. I have to make sure that I eat enough fat, because that was the issue that caused the liver damage initially. I was basically not eating enough fat, and so my body and my liver were basically shutting down. And so that's something that I just always have to keep an eye on. And then I just have to make sure that I don't engage in destructive behaviors like purging, and I remind myself, well, remember last time what happened to your teeth. Remember the scars on your hands from the purging and how those hurt. And I just remind myself about the negative effects that I experienced because of my restrictive behaviors or purging or compulsive exercising. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. We have another listener question that came in, and this one says, one of our best friends has been losing weight drastically over the last year. When we asked her about it, she told us it was nothing. She was just watching what she ate a little better now. We thought it might be an illness that she was embarrassed about, so we didn't say anything. When I later caught her in the bathroom making herself throw up the dinner she had just consumed at our house, I was shocked. She seems to be avoiding me and the subject now. How would you suggest I discuss this with her, support her, and/or find her help?
It's always a difficult question because you have to take it case by case and person by person. Some people are okay with a confrontational sit down, and other people aren't okay with that sort of confrontation. What I would say is just offer her support. You know, bring up the subject, bring up how much you care about her, and really emphasize that part. You know, I'm your friend, I care so much about you, and it hurts me to see you engaging in these behaviors. How can I help you? How can we get you help? And so that's basically how I would broach the issue, is just be supportive, offer your friendship, offer your care and love, and hopefully your friend will reciprocate.
Well, I think that's sound advice.
And I was just thinking, too, along those lines, in your book, you have a chapter called Building a Fortress. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. That was basically a mental barrier that I envisioned that would block the sick person. So a lot of this goes back to the treatment that therapists use with obsessive compulsive disorder, which is basically something called thought stopping. Mm-hmm. And basically what that is that every time you have this negative thought, which is promulgated by the sick person, like you need to restrict because you look large today or something like that, I'd basically yell back at the sick person either in my mind or out loud and just tell her, stop it, shut up, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. And I found that the more that you do that, the less and less that sick person says anything negative and the softer her voice becomes. So it's basically just about building this mental barrier, blocking the sick person's voice so that she becomes weaker and you become stronger. And that's what I found was successful for me, and all I know is also very successful with OCD.
Well, I'm thrilled that you are sharing that because I could say that as a therapist that it works mm-hmm. with the people I work with because I do specialize with anxiety and OCD. And thought stopping is a huge part of cognitive behavioral therapy and making that connection, making that thought stop. But it's so wonderful to hear someone that has been very successful and had that technique work for them. So thank you so much for sharing that and making me not sound crazy like, oh, yeah, she doesn't know what she's talking about. But somebody who actually has done it and worked with it says it works.
All right.
It does work.
Yeah. Now, Melissa, would you also say that your journaling also helped to get rid of that voice? That once you started journaling, which is what you were doing, that was the prerequisite to writing this book, was that equally beneficial?
Absolutely. You know, the journaling, the expressive writing, really helped me make sense of my experience, and it really allowed me to trace the origin and evolution of my disorder and. It allowed me to see that the sick person is not me. It's a separate person from me, and yet she's trying to dominate and control me. So expressive writing was extremely efficacious, and I always say that the book was the most therapeutic thing that I've ever done because it really was, mm-hmm. because it helped me understand myself, which is so essential.
Well, are there any other interventions or techniques that you had learned through this whole process that you might be able to share with others or that just worked for you really well?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things that I do are very cognitive behavioral therapy based. And then I do a lot of self-affirmations and schedules, and I keep track of what I'm eating, how much I'm exercising. And that journaling has been essential for me, mm-hmm. keeping track of what I've eaten today, what my caloric goals are, and how far I am from that and what I need to do in order to get that. To get there. So keeping track of everything has definitely been very, very helpful. And just talking about what I'm experiencing with my friends and my family, if I feel like I'm having a bad body image day or something, I don't keep it in anymore. I talk about it. I talk to my fiance about it. I talk to my parents about it. I talk to my friends about it. Mm-hmm. And just having that social support and that family support is really helpful for me. So those are just some of the other things that I do daily.
Well, Melissa, I think a lot of the things that you're sharing is hugely beneficial, and especially for the parents that are listening, mm-hmm. because we do get a lot of parents that listen, and these are parents whose children are in treatment centers, or maybe they're thinking about that as an option. What advice would you give to parents of a child exhibiting some of the same symptoms that you had, What advice would you give the parents on how they can maybe be able to communicate to their child better, so that maybe they don't have to go through some of the same trials that you had to go through?
I would say be very open with your children, even if they're young. You know, explain the situation to them in terms that they can understand, but don't hide things from them. Don't try to protect them by keeping things hidden. Like, you know, don't deceive your child into thinking that they aren't different, that they don't have a particular disorder when they have been diagnosed with the disorder. So I would say just be very open with your children. Talk to them regularly on a daily basis about what they're experiencing, about what they're feeling, and always be there for them. Always offer that support, because the social support is so essential in the recovery process, especially when a child is really struggling. And don't be afraid to, you know, do your own research. If you're going to a doctor and the doctor is prescribing your child with an array of different medications and not telling you what the medications mm-hmm. are for, what they do, what the side effects are, do your own research and really find out about those medications and find out about the doctor, because that doctor might not be the best fit for you and your child. So it's just keep the lines of communication very open.
Well, I think that is really important, those lines of communication. And education is the hugest factor, too, for the parents to be educated, like you had mentioned, but also, you know, their child to be educated that this is what we think's going on, and these are some of the side effects, and these are some of the things. This might be the reason why you do this and this. So they don't think that they're standing out there on a cliff by themselves. And they know that, I mean, everybody knows when there's something off from the norm, but you don't always know exactly what or why, and it's scary, I would imagine, very scary. And I was curious, Melissa, do you, I mean, if you feel free of sharing, but do you have any symptoms or any current diagnoses that you will continue to take for the rest of your life or work with or cope with, or are they pretty much all under control?
I mean, absolutely. The Tourette syndrome is always going to be with me. I still have tics on a regular basis, you know, and I still have to learn to cope with them. And some of the things that I try to do is I try to regulate my schedule so that the times that I have tics, I'm not expected to be giving class to the patient or something of that sort. So I purposely don't take night classes for that reason, because I do have more tics at night. I try to make accommodations in my life to make my life easier when I'm experiencing tics, like not scheduling exams when I know I'm more likely to have tics, like in the late afternoon. Mm-hmm. The learning disorder is still there. I don't like to read aloud, so I'm not the fastest reader. But I learned to make accommodations for myself. I have extended times on tests. I work with my professors. I work with tutors, you know, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And the eating disorder, I say now, by diagnostic criteria, according to the DSM, I do not have an eating disorder. However, I believe that I still have disordered eating, and that I do probably think about food in my eating patterns more than a typical person would. Mm-hmm. But as long as I'm aware of that, and as long as I don't allow that sick person to take over again, I believe that I'm fine, because medically I'm stable. My weight has been stable for over a year and a half, and I'm comfortable eating out. And it doesn't, eating disorder doesn't life. So I say that I have disordered eating mm-hmm. rather than an eating disorder.
Well, I can understand that. Now, I know you're at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, so that is fabulous. And you had just mentioned there that what you do is you schedule your tests and all that, based on your current pattern of when the Tourette's might be more prevalent. Now, do you think it's a good idea, as we were talking about open communication, to talking with the professor or teachers and asking for accommodations? Is that something, do you think parents or other young people should be doing to get those accommodations and those needs met for themselves?
Yes, definitely. All of my professors know that I have these accommodations, because I was I went to a diagnostician who basically wrote up a report for me that I gave to my school, and the help center basically produces a letter for me each semester, and I take that letter to each of my professors, and it lists my accommodations and what I need and what you know, things that I am able to do, such as taking a test in the testing center or something like that. So all of my professors know. They don't know necessarily what my disorders are. Mm-hmm. My advisor at school knows because I thought that that was essential to reveal to her. Mm-hmm. But my other professors don't necessarily know that I have these conditions. All they know is that I need these accommodations. And I think it's essential to use the accommodations and to get the appropriate accommodations because it really levels the playing field, so to speak, and allows you to perform like all the other people in your class. So I think accommodations are essential.
Right, and I think it's important not only in college, but in high school, you're able to get those accommodations too. You just have to get the right letters and get that information to the right person. Now, I was curious, have you ever had a professor or somebody be a little bit like, well, why should I give you a test in the morning when I plan on doing it in the afternoon? Any fallout from that?
In college, I've only had one negative experience with a professor. It was a chemistry professor, and I gave him my letter, and it was right before we were taking a safety quiz, and he basically looked down, read the letter, looked back up at me, and he said, "Are you sure you're going to be able to handle this? Because I'm kind of not thinking that you're going to be able to."
Wow.
That's really, in college, that's really the only negative experience that I've had with a professor. And I'm a junior, and so I've been through a lot of professors, so it's not a usual occurrence. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it sounds unusual that he was planting that negative seed to begin with. I mean, I don't know that I would have gone that way. Now, you were mentioning a lot when you were talking about the eating disorder, and you were talking about control, and it appears to me anyway that as you've gotten more control of your life, you've got so many great things going as far as, you know, you're in college, engaged to be married, you know, all of these things going on. Is it that you're getting more control of your life, and in doing so, you don't feel the need to have to control these other points like the eating and things like that? So it seems like one is, as you get better at one, it's helping kind of across the board. Does that sound right?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. You know, my life is no longer a chaotic jumble of symptoms and disorders. It makes sense now, and I feel as though I do have control over myself and my environment. You know, not completely. I still have tics. I still have learning disorders. But I'm coming to learn that's not a catastrophe. I can learn to cope with those conditions. And that in itself is affirming. And that in itself allows me to gain control over my body and my mind again. Mm-hmm. So it's really a combination of all of these things that have helped me recover from the eating disorder.
Yeah. And I was just curious, what are your dreams and hopes for your future?
Well, as I said, I would love to go to graduate school. My top choice is Yale. Of course, that is sort of an in-my-dreams scenario, but you can still dream. I would like to get a doctorate in clinical psychology with an emphasis on eating disorders and eating disorder prevention and Tourette syndrome.
I think both those diagnoses and, you know, both those conditions need more research, and they need more support, and they need more people like you that has a true understanding and can really work with the people that have that. Not a lot's been done on Tourette's, and eating disorders are all over the place, but there's not a lot of recognition, especially in the insurance companies, to support the recovery of it. So I think what you're doing and bringing more awareness to this is wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So, I just want to add for anybody that's listening, the book, we've spoken a little bit about it. If you want to get more information on the book, mm-hmm. you can go to Melissa's website, which is www.nourishedthebook.com. So that's the word nourishedthebook.com. You can get more information in regards to the book. And Melissa, can it also be purchased elsewhere?
Yes. The website is actually nourishmenttothebook.com.
Oh, thank you.
But it can be purchased at Barnes & Noble and Borders as well.
That's wonderful. So nourishment the book.
Nourishment the book. Okay,
just
good.
Like the title of the book is Nourishment, Feeding My Starving Soul When My Mind and Body Betray Me. And Melissa, we just want to thank you so much. Our time has gone by so quickly. Is there any last words you'd like to say real quick?
Well, I just, you know, I hope that my book will help somebody else or help their families or help their doctors. And I've always said that if the book will help one person, then I know that all of this would have been worth it. So I thank you so much for having me.
Well, and
it's been wonderful talking with you.
And we thank you for writing it, because I agree that, you know, if it does help, you know, it's going to help a lot more than one. Trust me. Having gone out and toured a lot of the schools, especially some of the girls' programs that deal with eating disorders, I can envision a lot of them reading this and really gaining a lot from it. So thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you so much for being with us.
And take care.
Thank you.
And thank you. And that's a wrap for us on Answers for the Family. Please join us next week at the same time.
Absolutely. And as I've told everybody, do something good every day. We will talk to you soon. We're out of here.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.
That wasn't the title of anything, so.
Yeah. I think we just got a typo.
Do you want this?